Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and by extension Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Candelars, I'm a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland and Western Australia. In the studio with me is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight Universities, and joining us online is Stephen Loosely, former Senator in the Australian Parliament during the Hawke-Keating governments, where he chaired both the Joint Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade and the Senate Regulations Committee. He's a businessman, former politician, defence and foreign affairs expert, trade expert and board member on the European Australian Business Council. Well, Stephen Loosely, we're both regular readers of your many newspaper columns, and a regular theme seems to be the increasingly fragile nature of Western democracies and what that means for international geopolitics. Are you optimistic for the future or pessimistic?
Having been a member of the Australian Labor Party for 52 years, I can only describe myself as an optimist. And I'm optimistic about the state of American democracy, particularly in the light of the congressional midterms just a week or so ago, and optimistic about what has happened in a number of other countries where the tide of populism has been rolled back. I'm thinking of Boris Johnson losing the prime ministership in the UK, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, and so on and so forth. I'm optimistic, but that doesn't mean to say there is any room for complacency. Democracy dies as a consequence of complacency and a failure to tend the plant.
You mentioned the results in America just recently, and we've seen what appears to be a poor result for the Trump section of American politics more generally. Do you see that as a potentially a bit of a turning point, or is that wishful thinking on behalf of progressive minded people?
It's definitely a turning point. And not only for progressives in the classic sense, be they Democrats or independents in the US, it's also a turning point for moderates amongst the Republican constituency. The New York Times did an assessment just recently, just a few days ago, about how much of a burden Donald Trump was in an endorsement. And Trump endorsed quite a few Trump NZ candidates for various offices. And in some crucial races, for example, particularly the Senate in Pennsylvania with Dr. Oz, they lost. Now, the Times estimates that there was a 5% gap between mainstream Republican candidates, most of whom were elected to office, for example, as secretaries of state, and Trump-backed candidates who failed, particularly in the Secretary of State polls. So I think we can say turning point has definitely been reached in the United States. Trump will spend the next year or so trashing alternatives in his own party and bemoaning the fate of America. It's fascinating that his speech at Mar-a-Lago announcing his candidacy for 2024 sounded remarkably like the speech that he made prior to the 2016 election. And this is after he's had 4 years in the White House, supposedly to address the problems that he maintains are so injurious to American life. I think we have seen the worst of the Trump fever in American politics, and it will probably settle down in the aftermath of the 2024 election, regardless of who is successful at the polls.
Where do you think Australia fits in all of this? Given your foreign affairs experience, your understanding of defence and international relations, where do you think Australia sits as a middle power in this changing geopolitical environment?
There are definitely challenges for us. There's no question about that. Our circumstances in geostrategic terms have been difficult over recent years, to the extent that we've not seen these kinds of threats that have emerged in the region since 1945. I agree with Richard Marles, the defence minister, the other night, talking about our strategic circumstances. But I think we've responded effectively. And in terms of working through issues with the United States, strengthening ANZUS, for example, making it certain that the Quad emerges as an effective partnership with the US, Japan, and India, and we can build further on that. And looking at AUKUS in terms of military technologies for the future, submarines attract the headlines, but artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and the like may turn out to be even more important to our security in the longer term. I think we've responded effectively, and the summitry in which Prime Minister Albanese has been engaged just recently, I think, underlines that. It's been successful in terms of relations with ASEAN, with the G20, and most recently with APEC. And President Xi Jinping agreeing to a meeting with the Australian Prime Minister is a signal that Beijing understands that the politics of intimidation and threat simply haven't worked in the Australian context. And the Chinese consistently ask Australia for a reset in the relationship. The Australian response is we require a stabilisation first before we consider reset, and that begins with the removal of the tariffs and other sanctions upon Australian goods. So I think our diplomacy has been effective. Our relations with allies and partners has been effective. We can build further on that. At the moment, the challenges are there, but I think we've addressed them in reasonably robust terms. I was in London a few weeks ago at a NATO-oriented conference on how we deter war in the 21st century. And the Japanese delegate and I, without breaking the confidence of the meeting, consistently argued for an approach with NATO plus in focus, that is looking at Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, as well as the NATO countries, which is accepted. And we saw in Madrid the NATO powers inviting representation from Australia, from Japan, and other Indo-Pacific countries. And I think that's a sign that there's a global response to the challenges emerging from dictatorships, particularly from Russia in Ukraine, and from China in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, and from some of these dumpster despotisms like the Iranians with their export of the weapons of war. So optimistic, but no room for complacency.
I note there was commentary actually just very recently about AUKUS and bringing in Japan into that context as well, beyond the Quad relationship. How do you think that would play out?
I think the closer the relationship between Australia and Japan, the better. It's in Japan's interests and Australia's interests. And we are very close on a lot of issues. If you look at the recent meeting between the Japanese and Australian prime ministers in Perth and the communique that was issued, it is very close to the language of ANZUS itself. In terms of bringing Japan into AUKUS on the basis of the technologies that are being developed, there's a very powerful argument for that. But I think the principle, Vicky, is this: the closer the relationship, not only in military and security terms, but in terms of the economic embrace that we've had since 1957, the close cultural links that we've had, and that essential relationship of trust between Canberra and Tokyo really does take us a long way down the path to enhance security.
You mentioned a couple of times there AUKUS. What's your view about AUKUS and the procurement of nuclear subs? Because what you've said thus far seems to jar with some of the statements made by one of your earlier bosses, Paul Keating.
Well, Paul has a particular view on these issues. I love him dearly and I agree with him on most things, but I disagree with him on this. Now, I need to be careful as I'm the deputy chair of TALIS Australia New Zealand, and the parent company in Paris has a stake in Val, a French submarine maker. So let me just say that we need to have the very best capability for the Australian Defence Force and the closest relations with allies and partners, the US and the UK. But I think the previous government could have handled the decision better. with a greater degree of sophistication, which would have avoided some of the clumsiness to which President Biden referred.
Do you, just getting back to the Paul Keating thing, though, do you think Keating is wrong when it comes to his views on where we sit with China?
I've known Paul for 40-odd years, and I understand it's probably not a good idea to critique his opinions. You generally are met with a flamethrower, a verbal flamethrower, and I've always learned to stand behind him in that circumstance. Look, he has a particular view on the relationship with China, which is much more optimistic about the good intentions of the Chinese Communist Party as he sees them. I don't share that view.
You have a passion for military history and a great understanding of the great historical and social forces that have helped shape the current geopolitical environment. Some commentators point to this decline of America and the rise of China as inevitable. Do you agree?
Nothing's inevitable in politics or life. We saw that on Tuesday in the United States where the commentators were saying, well, it would be a red wave. The Republicans would sweep the Democrats away in the House, take the senators as well, and Joe Biden would be a lame duck. Now, to date, none of that has happened. So inevitability is not a word to be used. In the same way, some political leaders are written off as impossible to elect. They will never be elected. And in my lifetime, I've seen people as different as John Howard and Paul Keating, Jeffrey Kennett and Bob Carr, so described, and they all won, and they won handsome victories. China's rise is to be welcomed in terms of lifting tens of millions of people out of poverty and hopefully China becoming a responsible player on the global stage. And was certainly hoped earlier this century. Now, the United States was described by a French socialist, Thibault Vertrain, at the beginning of this century as the hyperpower. It is no longer seen as the hyperpower. It is seen as having relatively declined in respect of Chinese growth across the board and the emergence of perhaps a more multipolar world. But the U.S. still remains first among equals in terms of its capacity to project power, in terms of its technologies, in terms of its economic strength. The key is to enable China to rise peacefully, to contribute not only to the region but to the globe, while having the United States continue to be particularly purposeful in guaranteeing the peace, not only in the Indo-Pacific, but more broadly. What's really interesting about the war in Ukraine is that the United States has again emerged, in Franklin Roosevelt's terms, as the arsenal of democracy. Now, it's had some partners carry the water too here, Britain in particular, of more recent times, the Germans. But the US has been the arsenal of democracy again. That's guaranteed the sovereignty of Ukraine by giving very brave Ukrainian troops in the field the weapons and the wherewithal that they need to resist Russian aggression. So it's one of those circumstances where history is tending to repeat itself, not always in Marx's terms as first as tragedy, then as fast. And we see certain elements of that in Ukraine. But the US re-emerging as the arsenal of democracy is quite extraordinary in this decade of the 21st century.
Well, we talk about the various streams of history. Some analysts have referred to the Thucydides trap, named after the historian who wrote about the clash of Athens and Sparta in the Peloponnesian Wars. And it says that a rising power challenges the dominance of an established power. That dominant power is likely to respond with violence. So do you disagree with that?
It's likely, but it is not inevitable. And there are various ways to work these issues through. I mean, the clash between the various Greek cities need not be reflected a couple of thousands of years later in
Point
human
taken.
Contemplations away.
But he's talking about a general theme, though, in international politics, though.
Yes, but in my younger days, I thought that Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels had discovered the laws of history. I was wrong. So I'm not sure that Thucydides is applicable in this particular circumstance. We are capable of having negotiations that bear fruit. For example, who would have thought in the middle of the 1980s in the last century that the Soviet Union would disappear 5 years later and that we'd have an end to the first Cold War? Now, we were probably in the West too triumphal in that time as the Soviet Union disappeared. Before we knew it, we were in a second Cold War when the Russians absorbed Crimea, were particularly aggressive in Eastern Europe, just as Beijing moved from being assertive to aggressive in this part of the world. These situations are not inevitable. Putin then misreads the preparedness of the West to defend our values. Did Xi misread the West in terms of Taiwan? Well, perhaps, but we haven't seen the kind of reckless behavior that the Russians have displayed in Ukraine. We haven't seen an effort to mount a cross straits invasion or lock Taiwan down with air and sea declarations by China of control. So there's always room to negotiate. And the fact that President Biden and President Xi had a three-hour meeting the other day is a positive sign. I've always agreed with Winston Churchill. Far better to jaw than to war.
You have a good understanding of universities more generally. You're a visiting fellow of the US Studies Centre at Sydney University, so you're well-versed in the world of universities. I want to ask you, in this podcast series, we've often talked about the role of higher education when it comes to soft diplomacy. Do you see the universities playing an important role in this regard in some of the issues that we've just spoken about?
Oh, yes, and a greater role. And Australian universities have the capacity to play a greater role. Vicky mentioned this to me the other day, and I was just thinking it through. In terms of what emerges from Ukraine after there is a peace settlement of sorts, and there will be a peace settlement of sorts. It might be months or a year down the track, but it will come. So we're going to have a series of Ukrainian universities that have been damaged, perhaps very badly, in the warfare that the Russians have unleashed. Why wouldn't Australian universities be in the foreground of helping to rebuild, not only in terms of the bricks and mortar, but in terms of the courses right across the board, be it medicine or philosophy? Why wouldn't Australian universities be in the foreground of having Ukrainian students welcomed into our lecture halls and tutorials and helping a new cadre of intellectuals in Ukraine who can serve their people and who can take Ukraine to the world? I mean, I think that's something that Australian universities would be well advised to start thinking about now.
I can tell you we are thinking about it. We're definitely thinking about it, Stephen. And in fact, it was a meeting that we had through the EABC, the European Australian Business Council, with the Ukrainian ambassador to Australia several months ago now, actually, where he actually talked about we need to be doing the rebuilding while we're fighting. And those words really stuck with me in terms of, well, what can we do as universities, apart from obviously offering some moral support to the thousands of scientists and researchers who've been displaced and universities which, you know, literally have been destroyed. And so certainly from our perspective, from the Group of Eight's perspective, that's something that we are looking at in terms of what support we can offer. And it's always strikes me as just, it's very heartwarming, actually, that we seem to be, you know, Australia is so far away from everything, but we still have a capacity to have such a huge impact in Ukraine, you know, in this case or in other areas that, you know, history will show that. And I think that is true for our international education and research piece as well. Not just in our region, but globally, we have the capacity to use the soft diplomacy of educating hundreds of thousands of students and doing global research with global partners, and we've talked about that with preeminent researchers in the past, and taking, they then take out from us, from Australia, our way of life, our learnings, our thinking, and that has to have a positive influence. So I think we are picking that up, Stephen, and that's a result of the European Australian Business Council dialogue we had with the Israeli ambassador.
Of which you're a board member, right, Stephen?
Yes, I am. I'm very pleased to play a modest role.
Yeah, so, and we saw in years previous where the Morrison government seemed to have, you know, a particular view about Chinese students and the dangers thereof and all that sort of thing, and it was a very testy relationship. Do you think that with the new government, with the Albanese government, we're getting a rethink on how universities can play a role with their student populations more generally, with soft diplomacy, developing relationships between countries?
I believe so, and I've known Jason Clare, the education minister, for decades. He's a very decent individual, a very thoughtful individual. I make no criticism of his immediate predecessors on the coalition side, but there's no question that some in the previous government simply saw Australian universities having a target on them and wanting to score points that they thought would assist them electorally, domestically. Now, I think that is gone. I don't detect that, though you see a fairly constant diet of stories about alleged woke excesses on university campuses and so on. I mean, I think we just have to be more confident in the sector. There was a former American ambassador, a very decent individual, A.B. Culverhouse, who said that he thought the United States had more confidence in Australia than Australians had in ourselves. That's probably true, and it applies in the university sector as in so many other sectors of our public life. So what Vicky's talking about is great news. Let's see that through and see how we contribute in the rebuild. And it's an exercise in Australian soft power, but it's an assertion of our preparedness as a democracy to do the right thing for people who've really stood up to defend the fledgling democracy in Ukraine.
We mentioned there the Albanese government. You recently compared the early days of the Albanese government to the first days of the Whitlam government. What did you mean?
It was topical in the sense that it was not long after it was revealed that Scott Morrison, for very odd reasons, had himself sworn in by the Governor General to a number of portfolios without telling the existing ministers or the cabinet or the parliament or indeed the Australian people what he was doing. I was surprised that he hadn't actually had himself sworn in as Governor General. It would have cut out
a lot easier.
And very odd behaviour. And I remembered that when the Whitlam government was elected December 2nd, 1972, Gough Whitlam and his deputy, the deputy PM, Lance Barnard, had themselves sworn in and covering all the portfolios in the new government. But they told everybody, it was made public. And they then proceeded to say, this is our platform. This is the Federal Labor platform. This was our manifesto. This is what we campaigned on. We have a mandate and we're going to implement. And they did. And so some of the newspapers, the Herald, the Age, the Australian and so on, as I recall, had a box on the front page every day for the first couple of weeks after the Labor government was elected, saying words to this effect, this is what the government did yesterday with a list of decisions that Whitlam and Barnard had taken. And those decisions stood the test of time. And I thought that was the best example of a translation by Federal Labor from opposition to government that I could recall. I thought it was better than the Hawke translation. That was very good. Certainly better than the Rudd translation. A little bit of stumbling there. And I thought, Mr. Albanese and company have done at least as well as this. And that's what I meant. You can do a lot of things in politics if you're open about it.
Yeah.
If you try and cover things up, you are going to be caught and generally humiliated.
And I think so that has been an early hallmark, actually, of the government, even from the perspective you mentioned, Ron, the kind of the constant tension that there was with the previous government, but also just transparency. I mean, they haven't overpromised on anything. In fact, I'm talking about our sector here. They've been very upfront with us. We've just had the announcement of an accord process for the university sector, a major review. It'll be really the first major review since the Dawkins reforms in the 80s. But the expectation management is real, and the minister has said this is not necessarily, well, it will be about money in the end, but that's not our starting point. It's about, is this system fit for purpose, mm-hmm. and what do we need to do to shift it? And then we'll look at the funding side. And so I think it's incumbent upon us as a sector and others, and in fact there are business people on the panel that will lead that accord, to be very bold with the sorts of things that we think we want, because the Dawkins era was fit for purpose for that period. But he will say now, and he has said this to me, he didn't think that that reform would last 40 years. You know, we haven't had significant reform in our sector. And of course, we're far more externally facing. We're very internationalised. We weren't as internationalised 40 years ago to that point. I don't think we'd even be having a discussion 40 years ago about whether universities could help rebuild Ukrainian universities, for example. So that's just one example of how different we are now and how broad our scope is.
Yeah.
It's an interesting feature of our history, Vicky, that the temporary becomes permanent. I remember the Dawkins reforms. I remember ILP national conferences. I supported Joe Dawkins at the time, but I always remember Parliament House Canberra of 1927 was still Parliament House Canberra in 1988, even though it was supposed to be a temporary building. We seem to have embraced the idea that once we've done something, well, we say, okay, get on with it. And Richard Miles actually said that about the defence budget the other night at the Sydney Institute dinner. You have to inject into the process a quality control, not just say, here's your budget, get on with it. So I'm pleased about the review in the tertiary sector. Mm.
So how do you think the Albanese government is performing overall? When you made that comparison between Whitlam and Albanese, I had in mind also that the Albanese government has come into power at a time when there are big economic issues at play, a difficult international environment, inflation, et cetera. Some of these things were the same things that Whitlam had to face at that time, but the Albanese government seems to have hit the ground running.
It has, and Jim Chalmers, as the Treasurer, has been very, very sure-footed, and he doesn't overcommit. And he doesn't talk in terms of instant results, and this helps. So, look, Gough did confront the oil crisis and other international developments. He had the most difficult early period since Jimmy Scullin became PM on the eve of the Great Depression. And the Labor government of the Whitlam era showed its weaknesses because we had been so long out of power. Now, the beauty of the Albanese government is that we have people who were familiar with the Hawke-Keating era, understand how government works, perhaps from within the parliamentary circumstance or another situation they've been involved in working with government. And I think that is showing at the moment. It's very deliberate as an administration, and it's determined, in Neville Rand's classic observation, to stay there. Neville always used to say that was the first decision of a Labor government, stay there. And you can do a lot when you're in power over a decade or so.
So there are similarities in relation to those two governments, but it is a very different Australian political scene, with the Greens more prominent. We're seeing the rise of the Teals. How do you see Australian politics changing in the years ahead? What are the emerging trends that you see in the future?
It's a circumstance where the Teals have emerged as essentially an offshoot of the Liberal Party. If you look at the Teal candidates who are successful, and there's some very able people numbered amongst them, most of them should have been the endorsed Liberal candidates for those seats, but they were not, and the electorate reacted accordingly. Some of that is a response to Scott Morrison's essential boganisation of the coalition, walking around the parliament carrying a lump of coal and and this sort of nonsense. And there's a factor in Australian politics that applies on both sides of the aisle. That is, if you dodge a bullet as a government at one election, you will cop a shotgun blast at the next. Now, that certainly happened to the Keating government, winning in 1993 when it was expected to lose, and being blasted in 1996, as Wayne Goss's memorable observation that people in Brisbane were waiting with baseball bats for Wayne Swan and Kevin Rudd. Actually, they were waiting for Paul at the time. So Morrison wins an unexpected result 3 years ago and is blasted at the next poll. There is a continuing focus on candidates rather than parties. In the United States, it's now a circumstance where in most polling, people are 30% identified as Democrats, 30% as Republicans, 40% as independents. And that's what's happening in Australia, in both the House and in the Senate. And that's likely to be reinforced, I suspect, at a state level in both Victoria and New South Wales, where elections are very much either immediate or on the horizon. And people are focused upon candidates and issues rather than the general cultural embrace of a political party.
So how does that work then for, you know, a workable government in future? Are you optimistic about that in the long term?
I am. I mean, I've always said, Chris Bowen is forever quoting John Curtin on this, and he's right. Labor governs alone or not at all. The commentary of the right calls the government in Canberra a Labor Greens coalition. It's not. Labor can work with a coalition, the Liberal and the National parties, on certain occasions, as it demonstrated Mark Dreyfus talking to the coalition about the National Integrity Commission, can work with the Teals, can work with other independents such as Bob Katter, and with the Greens where necessary in the Senate. But Labor has got to demonstrate fundamental commitments and fundamental beliefs in order to be able to negotiate and where necessary to amend and to trade. Exactly the same with the coalition. Peter Dutton will find this. So I think we have a circumstance in which there will need to be a greater flexibility in our system of government and a greater preparedness in the parliament to see things in terms of what may be achieved rather than what a particular party platform lays down.
Stephen Loosley, thanks very much for your time. Time is against us now, but it's been an all-encompassing chat about many things, including Thucydides. Thank you for your insights. It's been wonderful.
Ron, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen.
Vicky, thank you.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website, go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to Debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.